This is Web Talk Guys Radio, and my name is Rob Greenlee, and thank you for joining and listening today.
And I'm Web Girl Dana, and we're both here once again, every week we are, to bring you an inside peek into the future of the internet and into your digital lifestyle. We're heard on CNET Radio and also in Seattle and many other places, both on and offline.
Yes, and today on the show, we're going to go deep and take a look at the web through the eyes of a guy who says the web has completely remodeled many of our perceptions on just about everything. And I just read his book, and it really opened my eyes and really showed me some profound changes that the web is making in my life, I have to say.
Rob's been carrying that book
everywhere. The book is called Small Pieces Loosely Joined, A Unified Theory of the Web, and the author is David Weinberger, and he is joining us on the show today to carry on his thoughtful commentary and tell us all about his book. And he's also the co-author of the national bestseller, The Clue Train Manifesto, and is a frequent technology commentator for NPR's All Things Considered.
If you say that what's most basic to humans is that we connect with other human beings, that we're unthinkable apart, we're just howling monkeys. So if what we are fundamentally are connections to other people, then if you create a way of connecting to everybody in the globe, you've changed the very basics of what it means to be human, the way that we're connected. And that will only become more important over time.
And later we have a conversation with Greg Hampson. He's Microsoft's manager of corporate privacy. We'll talk to him about that balance between security and privacy and risks online.
It's a very tricky balance. Naturally, we don't want to give up all of our civil liberties because those are the things that we're fighting for, and we're fighting for the very preservation of our system. And yet the external threats are creating anxiety, real threats to those civil liberties in terms of the types of legislation that's being proposed.
All that ahead here on Web Talk Guys Radio.
Some news from around the web this week. The death of the meta tag. Top viruses for September, and we want to tell you a little bit about you, from what you've told us about the topics you want to hear about on the show. Rob?
The death of the meta tag has been something that's been happening for a long time now.
Tell us what a meta tag is for those who may not know.
What a meta tag is some code that's within an HTML page that helps a search engine identify what is in that page and what that page is all about. And what's happening here is a lot of people have really been jumping on the bandwagon of adding these little meta tag descriptions and keywords to their pages to help get better indexed in the search engines. Well, only one of the major search engines out there is actually supporting that, and it's the Ictomi folks. And they are still valuing that, but most of the rest of the search engines have decided that it's dead, dead, dead. Keep putting those keyword descriptions in there, but you don't have to put the keyword tag in there anymore because it's just not going to work.
Some other good advice comes to us from centralcommand.com. They're an antivirus software company, but they have been tallying the top viruses, if you can call them that, the top viruses that hit us last month in September.
The number one is the Clez E and G variant, and this is an email virus that comes in as an attachment, and it has the subject line WinXP patch.
So that's the most popular, or least popular, but most often sent virus out there.
The number two, I guess, most common virus out there is the Yahoo E virus, and that is also an email virus and has a subject line that's randomly selected, but oftentimes comes as a screensaver or as a love letter. And what it does is it disguises its executable codes by actually having an extension on there called loveletter.wave or some other extension that looks innocuous.
MP3, or, you think it's okay.
Exactly, but it's only displaying only part of that file name. So the rest of it is the destructive clue. So don't click on it and just delete those things.
The third most common virus is one called Elkern C.
And that one has a subject, hello.
And the fourth most common virus is one called SirCam. And finally, the last one is the granddaddy of them all, NIMDA.
Yeah, it's been around a long time, and that one has an attachment that says readme.exe. So hit that delete button.
We've been getting feedback from you, and oh, we so much appreciate it. And one of the things that we encourage you to do, and several of you have, is sign up for our newsletters. When you do, you have a little survey that Rob kind of put together for you. And he has some results for us. What are you going to tell us about?
The number one most requested topic for the show is streaming media. And it's 25, almost 26% of you voted for streaming media as a topic that you listen to.
And because of that, and thanks to our co-host, Dan Rayburn, who runs the streaming media show at streamingmediashow.com.
That's right.
We're supplying one every 2 weeks, a new interview just on streaming media.
So keep in mind, we are listening to you. So when you fill out that survey, we're going to give you what you want to hear.
The second most popular requested topic is broadband. Rob, have we had something lately?
Yeah, we actually recently, it's actually on the front page of the web.guys.com site right now, and it's called City-Owned Broadband.
The third most popular topic is web design, of course, 23% of you want to do that. And go check out Marie Tahir's interview on homepage usability. Yeah. That's really helpful.
And we've had a lot of flash design stuff too, so it's really interesting. And then online music, 22%. And to round out the top five was wireless internet, and we will be doing more on that in the future as well. This week's WebTalk Guys streaming media show, hosted by Dan Rayburn, is featuring Dave Fester, who's the general manager of Microsoft's Windows Digital Media Division, and he's going to offer an overview of the new Windows Media 9 series platform. So don't miss that. Go to streamingmediashow.com or just go to webtalkguys.com and click on the link at the top of the page. Now stay connected, because we're thrilled to have a fascinating author and commentator, David Weinberger, and he's going to talk about his new book, Small Pieces Loosely Joined. This is WebTalk Guys Radio.
This part of town gives me the creeps, but this is where Mr. North has his office. I'm Nat Worth, investigator.
Yeah, door's open.
With so many interests, I thought your office would be a little bigger.
Yeah, well, never mind that. What'd you dig up about the Tacoma deal? It's making me look bad here.
Those business people you're trying to hang on to? They found out that occupancy costs average less in Tacoma than up here.
Ooh, so they're getting a little fidgety. What else is new?
Well, they discovered they'd pay less in Tacoma for all those office-related expenses. You know, utilities, taxes, insurance, parking.
Tacoma's starting to get under my skin.
Did I tell you it's wired all over for easy broadband access?
You're kidding.
The commute times are faster.
Don't tell me.
About building permits in 8 weeks.
Stop!
Guaranteed.
Why are you telling me this story?
Well, with an office like this, I thought you'd be moved.
Tacoma. There are hundreds of success stories in the Wired City. Yours could be one of them. Find out how at WiredTacoma.com.
Grab a board and surf the web with those crazy web talk guys. Right here, right now.
You're back and connected to the Web Talk Guys radio show, and I'm Rob Greenlee, and I'm joined by web girl Dana. Thank you for joining us and listening again today on CNET Radio or from WindowsMedia.com or WebTalkGuys.com.
Rob, we're going to put a huge online jigsaw puzzle together today on the show. It should be really fun because we're going to talk with an author that has written a book, an incredible book that makes sense of all the changes that are happening to our lives because of the web and how this weird technology that we have here will continue to confuse us and bring us all together in new and exciting ways.
We're going to speak with David Weinberger, who's author of Small Pieces Loosely Joined at www.smallpieces.com, which is a great domain name. And he's here with us on the phone to discuss his insight in his new book on the changes that the web and the internet is causing. And he's going to talk about his concepts of time and space and really how the web and the internet is kind of evolving and changing all that for all of us in our lives. He is also the author of a national bestseller called The Clue Train Manifesto. And he also publishes an influential web newsletter out there called The JoHo, The Journal of Hyperlinked Organization. Well, that sounds like a mouthful. And is also a frequent technology commentator for NPR's All Things Considered and has written for many national industry magazines, the New York Times, Information Week, Harvard Business Review, and even Wired. Hey, David, thanks for joining us on the show.
Thanks for having me.
Since about 1996, I've become kind of a web addict myself, and the show is kind of a reflection of that, and I've jumped in there and tried every kind of web and online experience that I can, and what I really found with your book is that it really kind of opened my eyes to what's really been out there all along for me, and I just didn't notice it, which is the changes and the impact that the web has had on everybody's lives, including myself. Why don't you explain to us why your book does that? Well, I mean, what are you trying to do within your book that causes that, almost like a light bulb to go off in your reader's head?
In a way, the book is trying to get at a paradox, the way that we've taken up the web, which is the more you look at the web, the weirder it becomes. I mean, at times it begins to feel sort of homey, and then you think about it and you realize, boy, this is very odd compared to the real world. So that's one half of the paradox. And the other half is that here's a technology that's been adopted faster than any technology since Fire. And usually when a technology gets adopted quickly, it's because it's easy, it's simple, it's very familiar, and yet this is a technology that in many ways is completely weird. So there's something odd going on, and the book tries to get at that.
Mm-hmm.
And I think ultimately what the book says is that the way in which the experience of the web changes some of the most basic ideas about who we are.
Do you think that we've lost some people out there as this web and this new medium has evolved because of the confusion and the misunderstanding?
Yeah, sure. Of course, some people have. Oddly, it's often people who have been on the web before it was the web, back when it was the Internet, people
mm-hmm.
who were involved in setting it up, that I have some of the strangest conversations with. because frequently, they view the Internet as really just an information space. The rest of it feels sort of like fluff and a distraction from the real work. And they are not comfortable participating in a lot of the web stuff, more the side of the Internet that has more to do with communication,
mm-hmm.
with frivolity, the joy of connecting.
Certainly, it seems like it's become a little less rewarding or attractive to be very much kind of enthralled with the online experience. Do you think that that's been a positive thing? I mean, was there too many people out there that were too hyped up about it?
Tough question. Yes and no. On the one hand, sure. I mean, there's the thrill of the new when you discover the web and everything is exciting, and you get on email and you start flaming because you can, or you go to chat room, spending time basically being a jerk because you can. Yeah, it's not so bad when you lose some of that.
Mm-hmm. David, do you really think that the web has changed or impacted a lot of lives yet, or is it still at the beginning stages, do you think?
Well, I think both. I think it has absolutely affected hundreds of millions of lives.
Mm-hmm.
And we are just at the beginning in terms of the number of people who are online, which is somewhere over 500 million now, and in terms of the social connections that are being made, we're just at the beginning. Now, something as small as email, which I understand is technically an internet thing, not a web thing, but
yeah.
I don't find it very useful to differentiate those
mm-hmm.
two. Something as small as email has really had a huge impact on business. So when people say, as they sometimes do, well, you know, all this internet hype, it didn't really affect business very much. I just ask them to look at what life is like at their business after everybody's on email.
Yeah.
What happens to meetings? What happens to the way in which people talk across the org chart, up and down, as equals and as pals and making jokes? It's just that has been a huge effect.
What I see out there with, and I think email is a good example, is that it's turning into, from what I see, kind of a one-way medium to a certain extent. I don't know what you feel about this or not, but with the amount of spam that people get out there these days, I think there's a lot of people that are frustrated with email right now. Do you see that situation improving, or is everything, you think, going to transition over to the instant messenger type of a environment?
Oh, no, I think email is going to be with us,
okay.
And spam is always going to be with us. And I hope we are in this swing of the pendulum where the bad guys have the means to spam us all, and then we devise better anti-spam tools.
Yeah, exactly.
And then they swing. I hope we're at the far end of the pendulum because I'm getting, I don't know, 30 spams to every message I get now.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're seeing the same thing.
Nevertheless, the 1 out of 30 that I get, those remain as important to me as ever. In fact,
mm-hmm.
more important. I mean, I have friendships. I don't even know what to call them. I have people that I know only through email, that I've known for 10 years only through email. We'll probably never meet. We'll probably have them as friends for the rest of my life. It's a different type of friendship because it's more topic-based. We talk maybe once every 6 months about something that matters to us, and then we drift apart. So it's a very different sort of rhythm and nature of a friendship, but it's a real friendship.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm going to have it for the rest of my life, and my kids are going to have friends for 70 years that they've never met. We don't even have words for this type of thing.
Yeah. Certainly that leads into a really good aspect of what you wrote in your book, and I'm going to talk about that a little bit here, and that's the references that you use to space when it comes to online and offline and how we're trying to make the online experience more like an offline experience and how we're confusing our understanding of that. Could you kind of run down your thoughts on that, which I found in the book to be rather enlightening? You know, when we refer to a website, I'm going to go to that website or I'm leaving it or vice versa, and how that really differs from the real experience of what happens online.
Yeah, I mean, it is bizarre that we have a spatial
vocabulary for our experience on the web. Mm-hmm. But I take that very seriously. I mean, there's something, I assume that there is some real reason why the web feels spatial, even though you can't get much less spatial than sitting in front of a screen all day and looking at you know, two-dimensional electrons.
Yeah.
So I take both sides of that to be real. I mean, that is, we really do experience the web as spatial, even though it's not spatial in that sense. So that's a question. I think that that one of the important reasons why we do that is that our experience of space in the real world also doesn't really have a lot to do with the fact that there are measurable distances, you know, sort of an abstract three-dimensional grid, the Descartes-Newton thing of absolute space. That's all an abstraction. Our experience of space in the real world is that we walk into places. It's the space is filled, real-world space is filled with places that have meaning to us. Whether it's a living room or a dining room or a restaurant or a workplace or whatever, a swamp or a warehouse, each of these things have meaning, they have feeling, this whole set of significances. Right? So that's the space that we live in. Mm-hmm. Well, that's a lot like, and those spaces are connected. We can go from one to another. That's a lot like a description of the web, mm-hmm. where there are places that have meaning and significance because they're web pages. They have words and pictures on them. And those places are connected. And that's why the web feels spatial. It's not because it's some abstract three-dimensional container that we can move through. It's because, no, it's a bunch of places, and that's what the real-world space is to us as well in terms of how we live in the real world.
Well, one thought that I had when I was reading your book was, if all of the servers on the web were all located in one location, would the web be as global as we perceive it is today?
Well, I think we would still feel it as spatial.
Okay.
That is, we would still feel like we're going from place to place, because the places that we're going to, in terms of our how we experience and talk about the web, we don't know where the servers are.
Yeah.
You got to go to a lot of effort to find that out. It's the fact that these are sites that people have created and crafted, mm-hmm. and say something and have some emotional resonance with us and have links to other places. That's what gives it the spatial feel. And the reason why I think this is important it isn't just because it's interesting that we talk about the web as spatial. Mm-hmm. It's because I think it's an example of the overall import of the web.
Mm-hmm.
Well, there's a grand statement I'm not going to be able to fulfill, but I'm going to go ahead anyway. If the question that the book is dealing with is, why does this weird place also feel so familiar to us? So familiar that 500 million people have succeeded in getting onto it.
Mm-hmm.
Well, in terms of space, there's part of an answer.
Yeah.
The way that the nature of the web, of the web's space, is actually more like the truth about our real world experience of space. We think about the real world space frequently as being, you know, this giant container that has equidistant points in a three-dimensional matrix we mm-hmm. can measure and move around in.
Mm-hmm.
That's not how we experience the real world space. We experience real world space as a set of connected places. That's exactly what the web is. The web helps clarify the truth about our real world experience.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I think we find the web both weird and very familiar to us.
Stay connected as we continue our chat with David Weinberger. He's giving us his perspective on the massive changes that the web has brought about to humankind. This is Web.Guys Radio. The Web.Guys are thrilled to be your radio hosts, but we'd also be thrilled to host your website, too. The Web.Guys website hosting service combines a high-speed, dedicated internet connection and the marketing power of a link from the show's website to help you. We offer all the standard hosting stuff for a very low, limited-time hosting price of only $10 a month for the first 3 months. To learn more, go to WebTalkGuys.com and click on Web Services or email info@WebTalkGuys.com. You can reach us by calling area code 253-640-0164. Web.Guys, not just your radio hosts, but also your total hosting solution.
Get your .com drama right here, right now on the Web Talk Guys World Radio Show.
This is Web.Guys Radio. I'm Rob Greenlee, and that's Dana on the other mic.
And we're talking about how the web has really inflicted a lot of changes onto our lives and how technology may be confusing at times, but it's being brought together by our guest, David Weinberger. He's the author of Small Pieces, Loosely Joined.
As we evolve more into an immersive experience, and this kind of takes that whole space perspective to another level, with virtual reality and more experience through all of our senses of our bodies that we have right now, we're getting close to duplicating what we could potentially experience in the real world.
Yeah.
Now, how is that going to change our culture and our society? I know there's the movie Matrix, which I think is a terrific example of what could happen in the future if the technology keeps evolving the way it is. But where's this going?
Snow Crash is another one that was ahead of its time in many ways, except in one crucial. I mean, in Snow Crash, you get onto the internet as a set of three-dimensional buildings in a three-dimensional space, a virtual space. And I think it's pretty interesting that, in fact, the web has taken off at a tremendous rate without the 3D world happening. The avatars people said we were going to have walking down virtual streets with buildings, that hasn't happened.
Mm-hmm.
It doesn't seem to be required to happen because, in fact, that view of space mirrors exactly the worst of real-world space. The interesting thing about space is it's filled with rich places that are connected with one another.
Mm-hmm.
It's not that things have to be in one particular place related in a symmetrical way to other things like in the real world. That introduces distance. Distance is bad.
Mm-hmm.
Distance exists to keep us apart. The web's there to connect us. So I'm sure there are going to be places and applications where you're going to want a 3D view of web space. There's some interesting mapping places that do that. And, you know, I love Quake.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, it's a great place to game. But the basic experience of the web seems to not really want to have that 3D view. It gets in the way.
Do you see that thought evolving as the processing power accelerates and as we get higher speed access to the web where it will enable those type of environments?
It's going to enable applications where we want to have a 3D view.
Mm-hmm.
We'll have better and better Quake. We'll have better and better, there are topic maps of the internet where it's going to make sense to fly through a 3D space. There are going to be all sorts of 3D applications that, you know, I haven't thought of, but somebody real smart is going to.
Sure.
And we're going to use our processing power to do that. But I don't think that the web is waiting to develop a 3D avatar-based space, and then it's really going to take off.
Yeah.
You know, it's already really taken off.
You bet. That's true. Well, and another extension on this is your discussion within the book about documents, which kind of feeds right into this whole space issue a little bit too, and how you define documents online versus offline and how we value it differently. Could you kind of explain your philosophy on that? Because it's fascinating, and it showed me that a perception of the value of a document, being in a printed paper where somebody can share it with somebody, has a higher perceived value than a document that's online.
Documents have a really special role in the real world. They're all tied up with, not just with communicating information like a blank sheet, you know, an empty vessel. They're all tied up with authority. You see this in business all the time. It certainly has there's a religious tradition about books and the book as well. But even in business, you know, people wield a report like a sap. You know, it hit people like a mallet. They thud them down on the conference room table. And they're not just saying, here, admire my work. What they're saying is, I'm done. Shut up. Here's the report. You publish when it's done. And you publish often in that environment as a sign of authority. And you have a lot riding on it, too. People either accept it or they don't. Well, online publishing in general is helping to not only do the obvious things of making it easier for people to find stuff and to read it and to collaborate and so forth, all of which are really important, and breaking documents down into smaller size pieces that are linked and giving the user more control over how he or she reads the document. All those things are really important. But there's one other thing that I think is also important, which is that it's taking away from the thudding authority of the document, because documents in the real world are only published when they're done.
Mm-hmm.
And on the web, no particular reason why you have to wait till you're done.
Well, that or they're never done.
And in fact, exactly. In fact, they are never done.
Yeah.
And in fact, they become, I think in the best cases, they become conversations with readers
mm-hmm.
in various forms. That's so fundamentally changes the relationship of author and authority to reader that the implications are broad.
Well, on top of that, the concept of vandalizing a document is new. That's not something that you would experience offline, that's for sure.
No, that's right. I mean, you can go to the Nike site. Well, if you had the skills and inclinations of a hacker, you could go to the Nike site and spray paint it, so to speak, with whatever you wanted. Whereas to have the same effect, you'd have to take your spray can to every billboard that Nike, you know, it just can't be done.
Exactly.
We're talking with David Weinberger. He's the author of The Small Pieces, Loosely Joined. More with David in a moment. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
Yeah, man, I'll tell you what, that dang old internet, man, you just go on there and point and click, get in there, talk about www.com, and you got them naked chicks on there, man, you go click, 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 it's real easy, man.
You're still connected to the Web Talk Guys radio show. I'm Rob Greenlee, and Web Girl Dana's here.
And we have David Weinberger on the phone with us. David wrote a book, Small Pieces, Loosely Joined, and of course, his first national bestseller, The Clue Train Manifesto, made a huge impact on users of the internet. David's talking with us about his insights into the cultural changes that the web has brought to us. Since we're talking about evolving documents on, you know, what the web is good at, that makes me think of weblogs, and you just recently have, off of your website, smallpieces.com, a little streaming commentary about your philosophy and your thoughts about weblogs. Why don't you share that with us?
I'm really enthusiastic about weblogging. I started doing it seriously, 10 months ago or so. Although I gave myself an award when I started 10 months ago. Well, it's the web. You can give yourself your own award.
Yeah,
why
it's
wait,
easy
you know?
To do, yes.
I mean, nobody else was, so. I gave myself an award for the longest time between blog and weblog entries. I had started one a year and a half earlier and did two entries and stopped.
I can totally relate. I just started one 2 weeks ago and I've made one post.
Oh, you got to get in the habit.
That's right.
I think they're really important. They're what homepages were supposed to be way back when, in 95, when if you said web, people said, oh, I got to get me a homepage. And nobody could really quite figure out why anybody was going to read a static homepage, at least not more than once. So weblogs are the thing that we wanted out of homepages, which was a way for us to express ourselves, to talk about the things we care about. And they have evolved in the way that the web has, in a really sort of typical way, which is like in three stages, I think. The first is the inventors of weblogs, who were very technical, very geeky, and they were reporting on which links they had visited and which ones they liked, which is useful. It's sort of filtering through a person. But that got opened up a year and a half ago or so, so that anybody, not just technically inclined people, could write every day about what they cared about. And so you got a few hundred thousand teenagers who were writing for a handful of friends about whatever, why their schools suck and their parents suck or whatever it is. In the third stage, it's not really that neat, of course, but in the third stage, you have people who are blogging about topics that matter to them, and most important, linking up with other weblogs. So weblogs become highly conversational, with people referring back to an entry from somebody else yesterday and 20 posts following up on that, to the point where if you wanted to find out about some topic, there's a weblog thread about forgiveness a few weeks ago. If you wanted to explore the concept of forgiveness, you'd probably do better by reading through the 50 different weblog entries on the topic that came from theologians and part-time philosophers and wise guys and et cetera, than by going to a single source like an encyclopedia. A lot of the entries were made up or in other ways maybe worthless. Nevertheless, a whole bunch of them were highly valuable, and you get a set of subjective views that probably has more truth in it, taken as a whole, than any single so-called objective view.
Hmm.
So I think they're a very important addition to our culture, and will have some effect on the way that journalism, professional journalism, behaves in the future.
Yeah, certainly it seems like a strong avenue also for experts or a person that maybe wasn't considered to be an expert in a particular field or industry to kind of rise to the top based on other people linking to him and becoming kind of a star almost online. But is a normal average person out there going to have the ability to have a successful weblog? I guess that's my core question.
Well, yeah, I mean, first of all, I think you're absolutely right. I think that's a really interesting question when you look at the role that weblogs will eventually play in businesses, which mm-hmm. will fight them tooth and nail.
Mm-hmm.
But they're already, people are already writing them. So, but I also agree with the implication of the second part of what you say, namely that, well, weblogs are not, it's not like everybody who is an expert or has something to say is going to be heard, because weblogs favor good writers.
Mm-hmm.
And there are lots of really smart and interesting people who happen not to be very good writers or don't have the half an hour a day to do it. So, no, it's not weblogs aren't the coming of the promised land, but they are an important way for people to – an important addition to our culture. And also, you know, the teenagers who are writing weblogs, and of course not just teenagers, that they have 5 readers every day, that's not an unsuccessful weblog by any means. We're not, you know, measuring in terms of massness is one of the big lessons of the web is massness doesn't mean value necessarily.
Mm-hmm.
So the teenager who has 5 people reading her or his site every day, that's pretty thrilling. That's pretty important.
We have to take a quick break. We're talking with David Weinberger, the author of Small Pieces, loosely joined at smallpieces.com. More on the other side. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
This internet station sounds great on your computer, but you don't want to sit around in front of your computer all day. You have a life.
You got it.
Places to be and people to see.
You got that right.
Thanks to the Mobile Broadcast Network, you can take your tunes with you anywhere, anytime, and listen to your favorite internet station on your cell phone.
Awesome.
Get hooked up. The Mobile Broadcast Network is brought to you exclusively by XS Voice.
I'll be listening.
The WebTalk Guy is proud to be affiliated with the Mobile Broadcast Network. Just use any wireless phone to dial and access to amazing content like the Web Talk Guys, the Fox News Channel, Associated Press, the Vatican Radio, Israel Radio, Virgin Radio, all starting at under $6 a month. To get connected to the Web Talk Guys and other great news and music on your cell phone, click on over to www.webtalkguys.com and sign up at the Web Talk Guys Mobile Broadcast Network link.
They make it possible for you to hear your favorite internet station anytime, anywhere, on your cell phone, and listen to internet radio on the go.
Web Talk Guys, downloading.
Web Talk Guys, buffering.
Web Talk Radio is back. I'm Rob Greenlee, and I'm here with Web Girl Dana.
And we're having a conversation with David Weinberger. He's the author of Small Pieces, Loosely Joined. He's giving us his perspective at the moment on weblogs.
Certainly, it's about one-to-one relationships when it comes to the online experience, I think, anyway. And it's not, you know, and that even applies to a certain extent to even e-commerce online. I think that just getting traffic for traffic's sake is not what companies are doing anymore. I think that they're trying to attract the kind of customer or the traffic that will have an interest in what they're offering. And I think that applies to weblogs, too.
One of the lessons of the bubble is, you know, I sat in. I participated. I was guilty of.
I was too, so I'm with you.
Okay, excellent. at least many of us guilty ones actually paid for our sins in the bubble bursting. I'm not sure that's actually a good thing.
No, but we all live and learn, right?
Exactly. And one of the things that we learned was that when the business plan says, I don't know how we're going to make money, but I do know that if we can get 1 million eyeballs, we can't not make money, that is exactly the wrong type of thinking. That's real-world thinking where masses equal money. And it's exactly what should not have been brought onto the web as a way of thinking about business.
Yeah, I used to work for a free ISP, so I can totally relate.
Well, thank you very much. I mean it. As a member of the web community, one of the 500 million of us, let me take this opportunity to say, and I mean this, Thank you.
Yeah,
I'm not kidding.
Oh, yeah.
That's great.
Appreciate that. Let's talk about your comments within the book about the concept of imperfection being a successful formula for an online experience. And I think this flies in the face of conventional wisdom, especially when it applies to corporations and their perfect websites, which most of them aren't perfect anyway, but I think that they give the perception that they're perfect. And, and is that a turnoff to the online user, do you think?
Yes, and I think it's so common for businesses to maintain their anal perfectionism that they that they manage in the real world, to maintain it on the web, that we don't even know how offensive and alienating it is until we come to business sites that actually have a spark of life and humanity and personality to them.
Yeah.
I will tell you a story. My wife and I were buying a washer-dryer, I don't know, a year ago now, and I had it narrowed down to, well, what the hell, Kenmore, Maytag, because their branding messages worked, I guess. So I go to the Kenmore site, and I'm going to pick on Kenmore, but we ended up buying one. We like it, so I don't, you know. We go to the Kenmore site, and it's a total waste of time. It's marketing. It's, you know, Kenmore, smart, stylish, smart, simple, something like that. They have a take the Kenmore quiz, which is how well can you have you absorb Kenmore marketing messages.
Mm-hmm.
Completely typical.
Yeah.
So I'm only picking on them because they're so typical. Now, I actually had a question, which was, would the washing machine fit into the hole I had just cut in the counter? It takes like 8 clicks to get to that information. You got to go through marketing, marketing, marketing.
Yeah.
So actually, the story's false. I didn't go to the Kenmore site until afterwards. What I actually did was use Google, find a discussion forum, that home site, where people are talking about Kenmore versus Maytag. And that's where you get the real information. There's no point in going to the Kenmore site.
Mm-hmm.
Or to almost any other sites, like, I don't mean to pick on them, except that they're typical. The sites are conceived as, you know, once you step onto the corporate site, the assumption is that you are now in their control and they can market to you. But nobody goes to their site to be marketed to. We don't like being marketed to. And so why are we going to go there? Why would we go there? We get much better information from other customers.
Mm-hmm.
These sites are extremely alienating.
So when you talk about the concept of imperfection, you're not necessarily talking about spelling errors and things. You're talking about concepts of the use of the medium. Is that what you're saying?
I'm not saying introduce spelling errors.
No, I know.
although, you know, interesting marketing technique. what I mean is that if you talk to somebody from a company that you're buying something, while they're in their official role as salesperson or whatever, they'll be relentlessly upbeat. They won't tell you anything that's wrong with the product. They won't. They'll be very reluctant to compare it to another product, except insofar as it wins. Every product comparison chart has all the boxes filled in for this product with X's, and all the competitors are lacking something. And we know that it's lying. We just know that it's lying. If, on the other hand, you meet this person, I don't know, in a bar or at the PTA barbecue, and you're talking, now this person is going to level with you. And they're going to say, "Yeah, well, sure, it says it does double rinsing, but that really doesn't mean anything." The ability to admit that products and companies and services are not 100% perfect is crucial. Otherwise, there's no trust. There's no reason to trust them because we know they're lying. Well, the web, it seems to me, favors from the beginning. It's a homemade medium. It favors people who let themselves be heard in their real voice, talking about things that matter to them, admitting their imperfections, laughing at their own weaknesses and foibles. That's where so much of the appeal of the web comes.
Well, I think a perfect example of that was one where I first heard of you, which was listening to All Things Considered, and I heard your take just a few weeks after the 9/11 event, how cathartic the web was for people. And I want you to take a step back from some of the talk we've been doing, and let's talk about that event that changed so many people's lives and how the web played a role in it.
Well, just on that day, I think you got a really good sense of what the web is great at and why people care about it so much. I watched broadcast TV all morning because they had the pictures. I mean, that's what broadcast TV is fantastic at. But eventually, nobody knew anything about what was going on, right? We were totally mystified, and including the broadcasters. So they were repeating themselves.
Yeah.
They had nothing to say. So I went on the web, as did millions of people. And there, some of the discussion groups, the mailing lists that I'm on, which have nothing to do with this type of thing. Suddenly, of course, this was their topic, and people were asking questions, and we were getting answers from experts that we didn't know. Rob, as you say, we didn't know this person was an expert on aviation, and suddenly he or she's speaking up.
Mm-hmm.
So we're able to cl- clarify some of the rumors that we were hearing, including on broadcast TV. You know, somebody said that it must have been plastic guns. The discussion list that I'm on, that's for geeks, basically, turns out there are a couple of gun nuts on it, and they were able to say, no, couldn't have been plastic guns, because plastic guns have a whole lot of metal in them. So we're clarifying, despite the rumors that the Internet's rap as a source of bad information, it's also the best way we've ever had of clarifying information. Lots of email was being sent saying, I know you have relatives in New York. Is everybody okay? It was sort of national, you know, put up your hand and make sure that you're okay, the head count. A site went up within a few hours where people in New York could leave a message just to let their friends and a searchable place so their friends and family could see that they were okay. And people in their anger, and I guess it's understandable, but it was also, in my view, pretty stupid, they started leaving threats against Osama bin Laden.
Mm-hmm.
You know, or whoever, we're going to get you for this. Not what the site was there for. So somebody else modified that, put up a different site where you couldn't leave that type of message, much more useful. So what you had was, in the course of a couple of hours, the sort of rapid evolution of technology at a pace that's directly proportional to the human need.
Mm-hmm.
So, I mean, here's a case where we were educating one another, we were telling one another our stories, we were expressing our grief and our fear and our anger to one another. We were doing the thing that communities, in this case a global community, does when a hole has been punched in the sky, when you're in shock.
Mm-hmm.
The most basic human thing of telling stories and talking. And that's what I think is the web and the Internet ultimately are about.
The phenomenal thing that I saw was how people turned to the web as a source of information and as a source of sharing perspectives and thoughts. Like our show that's online, we saw phenomenal growth in traffic and listenership that day because people were clamoring to the web. They turned to the web to find out information about this event. And it was fascinating.
And you have to think it's for two basic reasons. What you weren't getting on broadcast, because broadcasts just can't do that this well. First was bottom-up reports, bottom-up from real people, grassroots journalism. Broadcast can't do that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not its nature. And the second thing is also something broadcast can't do, is connect us to one another. We're all connected to a central broadcast facing forward, receiving what's coming in, but the Internet lets us connect wildly, point-to-point, person-to-person. That's a tremendous... We've never, ever had that before.
Yeah,
I've got kids who take it for granted that they can post a review on Amazon or they can start up a weblog or a million other things, so that they can speak and the entire world can listen to them.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly. We did not have this growing up.
Oh, yeah, exactly.
It's a very different sense of what it means to live in a world.
David, we have about a minute left. I wanted to ask you, what's your prediction of how important the Internet's going to be to the human existence over the next 100 years or so? I mean, is it going to be something that invades everybody's life on the entire planet, or what's your thoughts on that?
Yeah, basically, yes. Is of course, you know, difficult to live up to, but here we have, if you say that what's most basic to humans, what makes us human beings, is that we connect with other human beings, that we're unthinkable apart from having grown up in a social community that gives us language and relationship and friendship, we're just howling monkeys. So if what we are fundamentally are connections to other people, then if you create a way of connecting to everybody in the globe and make it available to virtually everybody in the globe, you've changed the very basics of what it means to be human, the way that we're connected. And that will only become more important over time.
Yeah, that is true. Well, David, thank you for joining us on the show.
Oh, thanks so much for having me.
We've been speaking with David Weinberger, who's the author of Small Pieces, Loosely Joined. And go check it out at www.smallpieces.com. And, David, you have a terrific weekend, and I appreciate you spending time with us.
Well, thank you.
Okay, take care.
You too.
Now stay connected, because in a moment we'll be speaking with Greg Hemsa. He's the Corporate Privacy Manager over at Microsoft. And he's joining us to give us his perspective on the status quo of online privacy these days. This is Web Talk Guys Radio.
Welcome to the internet, my friend. How can I help you?
I'm interested in upgrading my 28.8 kilobaud internet connection to a 1.5 megabit fiber optic T1 line. Will you be able to provide an IP router that's compatible with my token ring Ethernet LAN configuration?
Can I have some money now?
You're connected to Web Talk Guys Radio. This is Web Girl Dana, and with me here is Rob Greenlee. As you can well imagine, in this day and age, trust, security, and privacy are a really big deal in this new online world that we have. And you mesh all that into issues of homeland security converging with online privacy, and you really do have a new world. We asked Greg Hampson to give us his perspective. Greg's a manager of corporate privacy at Microsoft. In Greg's 8 years at Microsoft, he's worked with Microsoft product groups to develop privacy technologies within Microsoft's different services and products, and he's part of Microsoft's corporate privacy group. Greg, we're talking about risks and privacy online. Do you have some key steps we should take to protect our privacy online?
Generally speaking, I try to limit the number of websites with whom I have specific business relationships where I'm asked to give up credit card data. So I'll do the research online, and then I'll just use the 800 number that they have on the site and place the order that way. Now, that may be a false security because there's a human being at the other end, and you're typically sending a credit card number over clear text on the phone line anyway, but I think it just provides me a certain sense of security that it's not exposed out in clear text out on the web. But I limit the number of vendors that I do business with. Banking online, again, even though I have multiple online banking relationships, I limit the online transactions to one banking institution, and I use an account that has relatively modest funding levels in it so that I'm not exposing a retirement account or something. Just common sense kind of things. I'm also very careful to adjust privacy settings that are available. I trash cookies almost after every session. Internet Explorer has good privacy settings based on the P3P protocol, and it allows you to manage cookies. So I'm very careful about what's left behind on my machine after I've surfed the web, and very carefully blow out history files and downloaded content.
Could you run down how the privacy settings in our browsers work?
Yeah, it's in Tools Options. There's a tab called Privacy in Internet Explorer. Generally speaking, the medium setting is fairly adequate, but for those people who have higher sensitivities to privacy considerations, might ratchet it up to medium high or even to the highest level, which is block all cookies. For those people who are less concerned about that, for whatever reason, you can drop the settings down even lower. If you take advantage of a lot of site personalization, you can exempt specific sites that you go to regularly so that they're exempt from the cookie handling mechanism, which allows you to enjoy the personalization that that particular site gives you while blocking the cookies of sites that you may not be terribly familiar with. I'd say managing cookies and looking at privacy statements are probably the two easiest things that people can do that can give them a reasonable level of comfort in engaging in online commerce.
What's your take on the security and privacy trade-off?
I think it's interesting that about a year ago at this time, the hottest topic for the online world and to a lesser extent offline was consumer privacy. And post 9/11, we're a whole lot more concerned about security. At least it's more topical with respect to pending legislation and legislation that's been passed. It's a very tricky balance. I'm not quite sure how you would characterize the right balance. We don't want to give up all of our civil liberties because those are the things that we're fighting for, and we're fighting for the very preservation of our system. And yet the external threats are creating anxiety about the types of threats that we're exposed to, but they're creating real threats to those civil liberties in terms of the types of legislation that's being proposed.
Should we be willing to give up some privacy in order to protect our national security?
There needs to be a lot of thought. I'm not, for example, in favor of a national ID card. I think that the potential misuse of that offsets the potential benefits. At the same time, in certain contexts, for travel, for perhaps driver's licensing, that type of thing, I think that there may be some benefit in allowing those systems to be tied together. But I'm not terribly enthusiastic about a single national ID number that can be shared across multiple government agencies, because I think the potential for misuse of that probably offsets the national security protections that it affords.
While at work at Microsoft, where do you go online?
I spend a lot of time on CNET, and because I find it to be probably one of the best sources of tech information. So I go from very broad general news to a narrower set of tech news to a very, very specific focus on certain websites that focus on a very narrow niche within tech.
That was Greg Hampson, Microsoft's Manager of Corporate Privacy, giving us the lowdown on privacy and security and risks online.
This is Web.Guys Radio.
And I'm Webgirl Dana.
And my name is Rob Greenlee, and we hope to have you back with us again next week. I'll see you around the net.
Thank you for downloading the WebTalk Guys. Bookmark us now for next week. Same WebTalk Guys time, same WebTalk Guys channel.